Thank you for joining me for John 9. I am getting a little bold. I'm going across the whole chapter today instead of a half chapter as usual. But that's because how are you going to break up the narrative of the man born blind and his interaction with Jesus? It's so good. So let's dive right in. We'll be in the Phillips translation as always, John 9. Here we go. Later, as Jesus walked along, he saw a man who had been blind from birth. And let's stop. Let's try, even for a moment, to understand what that fully meant for this man. At his birth, there would have been great rejoicing in his parents' hearts over the arrival of a son, an heir. And then there would have been almost an equal measure of exactly the opposite when it was realized that this boy could not see. Because in that culture, you understand, and as is evidenced by the disciples' next question, blindness was seen as a mark against the family and the individual. Even in the Levitical laws, a blind priest was purposefully kept away from the service. It was called, quote, a defect. Imagine that life. Imagine this man growing up under that cloud and in the darkness of both his blindness and that cultural stigma. Unable to play, unable to really properly learn, he is now sitting near the Temple of Jerusalem doing really the only thing that's available to him, begging. He has probably woken to this day without hope, certainly without any standing, without any form of mercy available to him other than the few coins that maybe, if he's lucky, will land in his cup today. I bet he has no expectation of a visit from God himself. Master, the disciples asked, whose sin caused this man's blindness? His own or his parents'? A question that our blind friend was probably not unused to hearing. But Jesus' response, however, would have had him leaning in a bit. He was not born blind because of his own sin or that of his parents, returned Jesus, but to show the power of God at work in him. We must carry on the work of him who sent me while the daylight lasts. Night is coming when no one can work. I am the world's light as long as I am in it. Now, my friends, can I put a fairly challenging thought in front of you? Because when we look at these statements of Jesus from outside of it, as readers, not firsthand hearers, I think that we should hear his words from a blended vantage point. Because we are really the disciples and we're the blind men. We are people who ourselves, we often struggle situationally, and it doesn't matter whether those are huge struggles or just little day-to-day challenges, but also we are the ones who have been tasked with carrying on that work of him who sent Jesus. So on any given day, as both components of this encounter, the disciple and the blind man, what should be our first thought when we are confronted with any hardship? I think it should be Jesus' words. He was not, insert whatever your struggle is here, because of sin, but to show the power of God at work in him. I don't know about you, but it reminds me of John the Baptist's words from back in chapter 3 of John. A man can receive nothing at all unless it is given him from heaven. But it even gets better here. Because the word that the disciple John has Jesus using for, quote, show the power of God, means, yes, make manifest, but it also means to make famous. My friends, every challenge, every struggle, any hardship at all has the possibility, in fact, it contains the opportunity, if we will believe in Jesus' power, to make him famous as we allow him to do his work in us. Can you trust him that way? Do you believe it's true that even our hardships can give him great glory? Let's go on. Having said this, Jesus spat on the ground and made a sort of clay with his saliva. And the blind man, hearing this, is probably thinking to himself, I'm sorry, what are you doing over there? This Jesus applied to the man's eyes. And imagine these hands slapping across his eyelids. And he's probably thinking to himself, boy, I sure hope that sound I just heard and that hand on my, I hope that had nothing to do with each other. And Jesus said to him, go and wash in the pool of Siloam. Now, Siloam means one who has been sent. Which brings us right back to that previous thought. Do you see it? The blind man is sent to the pool of apostle to come back having been healed as an apostle. His former hardship in the presence of Jesus is now a present testimony to Jesus' goodness. So the man went off and washed and came home with his sight restored. You and I, we cannot even begin to dream of beginning to understand what this was like for this man. He has never seen before, and suddenly all of those touch and sound and smelling sensations have become visual. Colors, depths, distances, perspectives that really must have overwhelmed his mind and heart with awe and joy. How he must have leapt and danced all through the streets like a madman. All of which makes all the smaller the reaction of the people around him. Listen to what the people say. His neighbors and the people who had often seen him before as a beggar remarked, "Isn't this the man who used to sit and beg?" "Yes, that's the one," said some. Others said, "No, but he's very like him." And the blind man, still relishing his newfound sight, is probably like a tennis fan going back and forth with his eyes, trying to understand, "Why are these people arguing about me?" But he himself said, "I am the man, all right." "Well, then how was your blindness cured?" they asked. "The man called Jesus made some clay and smeared it on my eyes," he replied. "Then he said, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and I washed, and that's how I got my sight." What a perfect testimony. There are no extraneous details. Did you get it? Just Jesus, clay, eyes, Siloam, wash, sight. And that should be a lesson to us. May you and I know the simplicities of our story with him, and then always, whenever we're given the chance, speak it plain and true. Our overemphasis of unnecessary details often means we underestimate the power of what he so simply has done in us. Let's be like this blind man. "Well, where is he now?" the crowd asked. "I don't know," he returned. And I think there's an undertone here of, "Yeah, I probably should have figured that out, huh?" So they brought the man who had once been blind before the Pharisees. It should be noted that Jesus made the clay and restored his sight on a Sabbath day. The Pharisees asked the question all over again as to how he had become able to see. "Well, he put clay on my eyes, I washed it off, now I can see. That's all," the man replied. And now his testimony is getting even simpler, isn't it? Then some of the Pharisees commented, "This man cannot be from God since he does not observe the Sabbath." "But how can a sinner give such wonderful signs as these?" others asked. And they were in two minds about Jesus. Finally, they asked the blind man again, "And what do you say about him? You're the one whose sight was restored." "I believe he is a prophet," he replied. And pay attention from here on out as we continue to the way that the blind man's belief will incrementally elevate until he's actually worshiping at the feet of Jesus. It's actually quite beautiful to imagine it. The Jews did not really believe that the man had been blind and then had become able to see until they had summoned his parents and asked them, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How does it happen that he can now see?" Oh, what a scene we've got now. The formerly blind man is standing over here in the corner, unbelievably frustrated that now it's suspect that he was even blind in the first place. And here comes these parents of the year, his parents. They're being called as credible witnesses. I mean, these are parents who've allowed their son to be out begging. They love him so much. I almost imagine that they had to pull his mother away from mom blogging or something to get her here. You can tell these two are a real pair. "We know that this is our son," they said, "and we know that he was born blind." So those are what the things they know. "But how he can see now, or who made him able to see, we have no idea. Why don't you ask him? He's a grown-up man. He can speak for himself." His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews who had already agreed that anybody who admitted that Christ had done this thing should be excommunicated. It was this fear which made his parents say, "Ask him, he's a grown-up man." So once again, they summoned the man who had been born blind. And imagine his frustration as he comes back to the center stage. Oh, he's so frustrated. And they say to him, "You should give God the glory for what has happened to you. We know that this man is a sinner." "Well, whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. But one thing I am sure of," the man replied, "I used to be blind, but now I can see." Between those two statements, his and the Pharisees, we are given a fascinating juxtaposition that hinges on the Greek word they both use, oida, to know. The Pharisees, quote, "know that this man is a sinner," a completely theoretical statement, while the formerly blind man, quote, "knows that though I was blind, now I see," which is a statement of concrete fact. Now, it should go without saying, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyways. You cannot follow a Jesus you know only in theory, only the Jesus you know in experienced, lived out fact. Whether people are calling Jesus a sinner or savior, theoretical knowledges about him always fall in the face of life and its circumstances. But do you think that this blind man could ever doubt the reality of his sight? That's how certainly lived out and known must be our testimony to Jesus and to his aliveness. Anything else won't get us through the concrete facts of our human life. But what did he do to you? How did he make you see? They continued. I've told you before, he replied. Weren't you listening? Why do you want to hear it all over again? Are you wanting to be his disciples too? And I love that our formerly blind friend is getting a little chippy now with the Pharisees. At this, they turned on him furiously. You're the one who is his disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this man, we don't even know where he came from. Now, here's an extraordinary thing, the man said. You don't know where he came from, and yet he gave me the gift of sight. Everybody knows that God does not listen to sinners. And do you see with that statement how he's now arguing against the Pharisees' earlier statement, we know that this man is a sinner. And in fact, watch how well he now destroys their illogical logic. It is the man who has a proper respect for God and does what God wants him to do. He's the one God listens to. Why? Since the world began, nobody's ever heard of a man who was born blind being given his sight. If this man did not come from God, he couldn't do such a thing. Now it's just really getting fun to me. I'm sure that some of you who are listening had the opportunity, for some of you it was a punishment, of taking an intro to philosophy class while you're going through college or at some other point in your life. For me, it was definitely not my cup of tea, but a few things about it occasionally crossed my mind, and here's one of them. This man, again, only recently a blind beggar, is now standing before the powerful, learned Pharisees and is dropping on them a loose version of what's called a hypothetical syllogism. The way that argument goes is this. If P, then Q. If Q, then R. Therefore, if P, then R. Do you see how the logic kind of arcs across that spectrum? So listen to it again. I'm going to reread that section. It is the man who has a proper respect for God and does what God wants him to do. He's the one God listens to. Why? Since the world began, nobody's ever heard of a man who was born blind being given his sight. If this man did not come from God, he couldn't do such a thing. So listen to how it follows. His first statement, if respect and obedience, that would be the P, God listens. That's the Q, cause and effect. Then, if God listens, Q, sight restored, R. Therefore, all of these things being true, he is from God. Isn't that kind of stunning? To me, this moment is the literal example of the meaning of 1 Corinthians 1. It is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. For consider, what have the philosopher, the writer, and the critic of this world to show for all their wisdom? Has not God made the wisdom of this world look foolish? For it was after the world in its wisdom failed to know God that he in his wisdom chose to save all who would believe by the simple-mindedness of the gospel message. God's foolishness is wiser than men, and his weakness is stronger than men. Let's go on. You misbegotten wretch, they flung back at him. Are you trying to teach us? And they threw him out. Now Jesus heard that they had expelled him, and when he had found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? Now imagine this moment from our formerly blind friend's perspective. He's only just been able to see for the first time. Then he's dragged into this kangaroo court before the Pharisees. His mom and dad get involved. And now maybe because of his own defiance, there's a chance he himself is going to be excommunicated from worship permanently. What a day. Now he is walking through the streets of Jerusalem, probably a little anxious, and also still overwhelmed with this gift of sight. Everything is so beautiful. It's so colorful. It's interesting to him, every little detail. He turns onto a certain street. Out ahead, and yet almost seemingly coming toward him, there's a man whose eyes are locked on him. That man walks right up, his eyes piercing him, and rests a hand on his shoulder. "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "And who is he, sir?" the man replied. "Tell me, so that I can believe in him." "You have seen him," replied Jesus. And suddenly I think that voice begins to sound incredibly familiar to the formerly blind man. "It is the one who is talking to you now." "Lord, I do believe," he said, and worshiped him. Isn't that beautiful? At the dawning of this day, Jesus was nothing to this man. Then he was a healer. Then he was a prophet. Then he was from God. Then he's God himself. And all of this all in one day. This week, I have been so struck by the wording of the immediacy of the wording of verse 38. "And he said, I believe, Lord," and he worshiped him. Presumably, he did not say, "I believe, Lord," while a church piano player started playing powerful background power chords and the rest of the band quietly took the stage and slipped on their guitar straps. No. More likely, they are standing in the midst of a busy, bustling, dusty, dirty street in the midst of life happening all around them. And he worshiped him. Imagine if you yourself had been walking by and you saw a man bowing before a man. His eyes filled with joy, reverence, laughter, and this power of belief. You yourself might just be going around doing your life. But that man, the one down there on the dust, the one with that wild look in his eyes, he has something going on that you have no idea about. His worship confronts your reality more intently than any words he might say to you. Who is this one who could call such things up in a person? My friends, is that our worship? Does it actually interfere with the normalcy of our lives? Is our worship silently confrontive just because it never leaves our faces? Oh, I certainly hope so. Let's go on. Then Jesus said, "My coming into this world is itself a judgment. Those who cannot see have their eyes opened, and those who think they can see become blind." Which is a fascinating wording. He's saying that the Pharisees, who were about to rise to his bait, actually had been seers, but now, with his coming, have become blind. Their eyes and hearts and minds had been so totally fixed on the law. They really, by the law, could see, but now in the presence of he who came not to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill it, and in not believing in him, they have become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him overheard this and said, "Oh, so we're blind too, are we?" "If you were blind," returned Jesus, meaning if they admitted it, "nobody could blame you. And in fact, based on this day, he could heal them. But as you insist we can see, your guilt remains." The chapter ends with this fairly ominous note. And yet the way that John words it in the Greek paints a picture of the spiritual realities in play perfectly. Jesus says, "Since, however, you say we see, your sin abides." It abides. Did you hear it? It abides in them, and they in it. Only Jesus, my friends, can open the eyes. Only Jesus is to be worshipped. Only by abiding in Jesus and he in us, are we given eyes to see, and are we set free of the sin abiding that makes men blind? Even now, even in that moment, these Pharisees could have turned to him and had their eyes opened, the eyes of their heart. Especially now, you and I, we must turn to Jesus, give him our whole hearts, and give our whole life to the act of abiding in him rather than sin. Oh, may our lives look almost identical to the man who had been born blind. What a dream that would be.